Good morning. Still have a few more minutes to go. So, how's everybody doing this morning? Enjoying the show so far? My first visit to Amsterdam. It's a great place. Smaller event than TechEd North America, but much better in a lot of ways. So, how many of you are on Exchange 2010? Great. How many of you are using archiving on-premises? Okay. Third-party archiving? Great. Good to see some show of hands. So you'll probably know what I'm talking about, and as I'm talking, you're probably trying to compare what Exchange archiving looks like compared to your third-party archiving systems. So for those who don't know me, my name is Bharat Soneja. I'm the senior technical writer in Exchange product group. I take care of compliance and security, as well as Exchange search. Compliance includes all kinds of stuff today. How many of you use journaling? Okay. Everybody familiar with journaling? And how it feeds archiving systems? Great. So while we still have a few minutes, I am just one more minute to go. I'm going to put on a little video.
Paul is responsible for his company's email archiving system. They used to archive email using journaling, which stores messages in a special external mailbox. When Paul joined the company, journaling to a third party was pretty much the only choice. But it had problems. The process of getting messages into the external mailbox can alter them and even open them up to intentional tampering. That made Paul a bit nervous. To comply with discovery requests, Paul might have to reconcile his journaled archive with his Exchange data. In other words, he would have to search both mailboxes. No easy matter if you're talking about millions of messages. Also, journaling only captures email and meeting requests. Other calendar items don't get archived, nor do tasks and contacts, all of which can be important for discovery requests. Paul could use a third-party add-on to capture that data, but he'd have to manage it separately, and it might get in the way of future Exchange upgrades. For all those reasons, Paul replaced journaling with in-place archiving. It's built into Exchange. No third-party software or separate archives are required. Messages are preserved exactly as they were when the user last sent, received, or edited them, including metadata. Exchange can archive all the items in a user's inbox, so everything is discoverable, not just email. It even preserves folder structure. Best of all for Paul, with in-place archiving, he only has one system to manage. He trusts Exchange with mission-critical email, and now he can use the same system for archiving.
So, okay, let's get started. So, I'm going to just, some of you saw the intro slide I had, but I'm going to skip that over and just going to ask a question. How much does it cost to store unlimited amounts of email in an archive for one user? Any ideas? Any numbers from your own deployments of archiving or unlimited amounts of email per mailbox? Anybody? I'm sorry? €5 per month. Okay. I didn't think about euros. The pricing I was looking at was dollars, but that's kind of a good price. I would say, €5 per month per user for unlimited amount of email. Now, that could be 20 gigs, 30 gigs, 40 gigs, and all the high availability that comes with a deployment in the cloud. No backups, no worries about what to store, how long to store. It's all easily done. So I'm going to quickly switch to my TechEd US slide, which said, what costs less than a latte? Less than the price of a coffee, but stores your email, unlimited email, and helps you in compliance and discovery. So the price for Exchange Online Archiving, sorry, I don't have the euro price. I totally didn't think about it, is $3 a month per user. Unlimited amounts of email. Let's see how we can go and make that possible. So why archive? The biggest reason for archiving, of course, is compliance. The fact that you need to keep a lot of email due to business reasons, due to compliance reasons. You need to meet e-discovery requests. You are in an industry that requires you to store email for X amount of years, you know, as a best practice or by laws in the country or in the industry that you operate in. So, you know, you can throw your numbers out there. 5 years, some want to store all the email for 7 years, okay? And with this comes the cost of storage. As mailboxes grow, you're going to spend more and more money on storage. So archiving allows you to balance the mailbox size demands from users and for your compliance reasons with available resources, the amount of money that you have to spend on storage. It also, one of the biggest issues was PST files. We loved PST files. We don't love them as much anymore. And the reason we don't love them as much anymore has nothing to do with PST functionality, but it has everything to do with what it costs for me as a compliance officer to go out and look for these PSTs on the network. Users have these PST files on their laptops, on their desktops. They have it on a USB stick or other removable media. And they're taking enterprise or your organization data and putting it on removable storage or computers with no accountability whatsoever, no IT control whatsoever on all this data. And when it comes time for discovery, and if you don't have all this email, and you have to go looking for PSTs, so quick show of hands, how many of you have indulged in such an endeavor to go look for PSTs on user computers when you have a discovery request? Anybody done that? It's not something you will be fond of. Let me just put it that way. So PST is bad. The other thing is keep mailboxes smaller. So you ship old historical data that is not used very frequently, but your organization might need it for compliance. The user might need it. Oh, I'm going to refer to this email. I don't need it every day, but I still need it. You know, users like to store everything. And if you didn't put mailbox quotas, they would store all their email and never delete anything. So this helps you keep a smaller mailbox, primary mailbox, and ship all your data to an archive. Of course, meet your compliance requirements, meet your discovery requirements. Also preserve valuable intellectual property data. It doesn't get lost just because you need a smaller mailbox. And as we talked about, discovery. When you get a request to fulfill for discovery, you have to go out and search all these mailboxes and archives. Putting all this data in the archive will also reduce cost of archiving, I mean of discovery. Now, what did we do before Exchange 2010? Of course, we used journaling. What journaling does is it's a journaling agent. It runs on hub transport servers, and you create journal rules. You can also do per mailbox database journaling in Exchange 2007 and 2010. And every message that gets sent or received, if it matches parameters of your journal rule, it generates a journal report. And the journal report has the original message attached to it. And in the body of the journal report, you find all the metadata, like the sender, the subject, the message ID, who it was sent to, who was CC'd, who was BCC'd or blind copied to the message. And if there were any distribution lists that you sent out this message to, it would expand that distribution list and include all the recipients from the distribution list onto that journal report. Now, as a discovery officer, this gives me a good idea of all the recipients that the email was sent to. And there are some caveats to that. If you had distribution lists with more than 1,000 recipients, then this journal report will get forked and you will have multiple messages, because each message gets expanded to about 1,000 recipients before it forks into another message. So you'll see some additional journal reports. One of the issues with journaling, of course, is items. It's a transport agent. It runs on hub transport servers. So think about all the message types that you send and receive. If they are going through transport, that means all messages, meeting requests, these all go through transport. They're going to get journaled. But things like, you know, my appointments and other items, tasks, now those are things that the user creates. They stay in the mailbox. They do not go through the transport pipeline because user is not sending and receiving that. Those items will not get journaled. So important thing to remember about journaling. More information throughout the presentation. You will see these links at the bottom. These are short URLs. aka.ms is our own URL shortening system, so you know these are all created by internal Microsoft employees. And we've given you a very easy way to get to documentation and other resources. So for journaling, it is aka.ms/journaling, and you can read up more about journaling there. Now, let's move on to Exchange 2010, where we introduce the concept of personal archives, or what we call then personal archives, or in-place archiving. Now, if you're using third-party archiving and compliance systems, how do they work? They typically take data from your exchange, either using journaling. There are also some archiving systems that actually make a MAPI connection to the mailbox and suck data out of it and move it to an archive and leave a stub in place so the user can access the message in the archive. Now, to make that possible, they use an Outlook plugin. So the plugin interprets the stub in the mailbox that points to the actual message in the third-party archiving system. And you click on the stub, and it will go fetch the archive message and render it in Outlook. So there is costs of the third-party archiving systems, costs of deploying the Outlook plugin to all the users you enable the archive for. There is different set of management tools that you're going to have to deal with and learn in addition to Exchange. With in-place archiving, it's all built into Exchange. So instead of taking data from Exchange and putting it into another database to make archiving possible, in all its complexity, what you're doing is leaving the data in Exchange. But instead of leaving it in the user's primary mailbox, you move that message to an archive mailbox. So that's what an archive is. It's another mailbox associated with the user, and you're shipping all the data, historical data, that the user is not accessing very frequently into that archive. Now, the primary mailbox is cached. When you're running Outlook in cache mode, you have an OST file, and let's say your mailbox is 5 gigs or 7 gigs or 10 gigs, it's all getting cached locally. The archive mailbox is never cached. You're only accessing it when you're online. So it resolves one of the issues with all the data going back and forth. It could be 20 gigs. If your primary mailbox is, let's say, 5 gigs, your archive is, let's say, 15 gigs, 20 gigs. Now you're not pulling all that data down to your individual computers every time. So that is in-place archiving. It helps you consolidate storage compared to third-party systems where you have, again, your third-party archiving system database and its own storage. Now, this lets you use same storage that you use for Exchange and locate your archives on it. It can be on the same mailbox database. It can be on another mailbox database. It can be on a different Exchange 2010 server. So you can do whatever you want in terms of storage. Simplified management. So there's no third-party tools now. You're just using Exchange tools, the Exchange Management Console, and the Exchange Shell, and the Exchange Control Panel, tools that you already know and tools that you already use day-to-day to manage Exchange. What's the user experience like? It's very close to a PST file. In fact, most users will not be able to tell if it's a PST or not, except it's always available when they're online, regardless of what computer they log on from. The other big difference is, unlike PST files, the archive is available using Outlook Web App. So now you have a web browser-based access from anywhere you are. That's not something PSTs can do. You use move to archive policies. And let's say you set up a policy, default move policy, to move all old email older than 2 years, for example, and move it to archive automatically. The archive admin experience, like we talked about, is very, very seamless. You're using the same tools. Create new mailbox, create an archive. Move mailbox, move an archive. Very, very similar, using the same mailbox move requests and the same tools that you're using now. How does high availability work if you're on premises? The same things that you do for your primary mailbox, you're going to do for your archive mailbox. Or you could say, hey, all my primary mailboxes reside on this super expensive storage, which is low latency. But my old email, I can use tiered storage, and I can offload it to another mailbox database or another Exchange server and place all my archive mailboxes there on premises. So that is the on-premises scenario. So let's take a look at the archive experience. So I have a user here that's my own mailbox, actually. And let's go and take a look at what the archive is going to look like in OWA once I have created it. Okay, so I'm in Outlook Web App. Okay, so what you see on top here is my primary mailbox, just like you would expect to. But what you see on the bottom here is the personal archive in the cloud. And it may take a few seconds to refresh, as you see down there. There we go. So I've just expanded the folders in my online archive. And I can move messages back and forth just as I would in a PST file. So I've got this message here. I can move it to the Do Not Delete folder right here. And the message just got moved to the cloud-based archive. Let's take a look at the archive here. There we go. May take a few seconds to appear here. Now let's try and connect to Outlook meanwhile and see what Outlook looks like. And it looks pretty similar as your PST file. Looks like another user is logged on to this workstation. Won't let me log in, so I'm going to skip the Outlook part, but it looks pretty similar as what you saw in OWA. So you can drag and drop messages. Users can go ahead and create rules in Outlook to move messages to the archive, just like they move messages to any folder. Users can apply retention policies to move items after any period that they want. You know, 2 years, 1 year. We'll take a look at how all of that works. So some of the scenarios that we have in the cloud, of course, is fully hosted, but you have your primary mailbox and your archive in the cloud. This is your typical Office 365 deployment. Then you have the cross-premises coexistence, or what is known as a hybrid deployment, where you have some users with a primary and archive in your on-premises Exchange servers. And then you have some users who have their primary and archive in the cloud. So we're not talking about these two scenarios. These are pretty simple and straightforward. What we're going to talk today about is Exchange Online Archiving, which is the service that we offer to have on-premises primary mailboxes and have archives in the cloud. So you require a hybrid deployment to do this, and we'll go through how all of that works. Now, it's a per-user setting. So like I said, you could have some mailboxes with both primary and archive on-premises on an Exchange 2010 server. And then you can have some mailboxes where the primary is on-prem, archive is in the cloud. The big deal is unlimited quota. There are no mailbox quotas to deal with. So you get unlimited amount of storage to store historical email in the cloud. Seamless user compliance. You use the same messaging retention management policies, retention tags, retention policies. You can use the same hold policy to place a legal hold on a user. We'll take a look at that. You can run e-discovery on these cloud-based archives, just like you would run e-discovery on your primary mailboxes. And finally, auditing. Who has access to the mailbox? We'll take a look at that as well. All management actions are performed using your on-premises tools. So your EMC, your shell, and your ECP, or Exchange Control Panel. So what does it look like? So on the left, you have your on-premises Exchange. You have a bunch of Exchange servers. You have Active Directory. What you will need to add is a DirSync server. Now, depending on your requirements, this can be a separate box, or it can reside on an existing Exchange server. What it cannot reside on is another domain controller. So DirSync and domain controllers do not go together. Next, you will require ADFS. We'll take a look at what ADFS, or Active Directory Federation Services, does. So you provision a new cloud-based mailbox, or cloud-based archive, rather, using your EMC. Under the covers, EMC fires off a commandlet, enable mailbox, with a remote archive. That writes to your Active Directory, creates the objects there. From Active Directory, dir sync picks it up and performs a forward sync to the dir sync in Exchange Online, which is the service in Microsoft data centers. And your directory information gets replicated there, that a new user has been created, and create a new archive in the cloud. Now, from the dir sync, your archive gets provisioned, okay, writes back to the AD in the cloud. This is your organization in the cloud. You have an on-premises exchange organization, and then you have a cloud-based exchange organization, and it creates the same objects that you have in your on-prem into the cloud using the dir sync process. Now, not all the attributes of your objects in AD are replicated. It only replicates the attributes that are required to make this hybrid configuration possible. So once this is done, the archive gets created in the cloud. It then initiates a dir sync write back process, and it writes back to your Active Directory. And all it writes is, hey, the archive is created now. Users can have access to it once this is flipped. Now, how long does this take? When you run step number one of provisioning the archive, the dir sync doesn't take very long to replicate it to the cloud. The creation of the archive in the cloud does not take very long, though you can kick it in by manually initiating the dir sync process. And there's a command for that. We'll take a look at it in just a moment. Now, the write back from the cloud takes a little bit longer. It could take a few hours. So your users will not have access to their cloud-based archive until that write back occurs. It goes and flips an attribute in your Active Directory for that user, saying the cloud-based archive is now provisioned. But if you wanted the user to have access to that cloud-based archive sooner, you can go and flip that bit manually. You can use Active Directory Users and Computers or etcedit. There is also a script on the Exchange Team blog to allow you to do that. So now, with this archive created, now I can say get mailbox archive, and it will show me the archive has been created. So let's quickly go take a look at what this archive looks like in the cloud. Okay. So first of all, what we're going to do is, in Exchange Management Console, you can go and select your view. Add remove columns. And in here, you can add archive database and archive state columns. And let's move this up, because that's what our primary interest is right now, so we don't have to scroll a lot. Okay. So as you can see, some of these users have their archive on database called DB01. In the archive state column, you will see local archive created. So these are all on-premises archives. But users who have a cloud-based archive, it will say cloud-based archive created. Okay. And also for the users who have a cloud-based archive, from Exchange Online, we do not care about what mailbox server it is in Microsoft's data center. We do not care about what mailbox database it resides on. So that information is never written back to your Active Directory, which means you will not see an archive database for the cloud-based archive. So that's the big difference here. And one way to quickly tell whether a mailbox, an archive is cloud-based or on-premises. Now, how does it look in your user attributes? So you say get mailbox. I'm going to run a filter. Archive good not equals null. And we're going to select the first one user and take a look at all the archive attributes for that user. Okay, so is this an on-premises archive or is this a cloud-based archive? Can you tell? Yes? In on-premises, because it has the mailbox database populated. Okay, let's find out our cloud-based archives. So now we go and change the filter to archive domain not equals null. And there we go. So the archive database on the cloud-based archive is empty. But the archive domain points to my Exchange Online account or my cloud-based exchange organization, which is e15rocks.mail.onmicrosoft.com. So that's the difference. I can go and find all the users who have a cloud-based archive. Okay, I can give you a count of how many cloud-based 8 archives are in the cloud. Same way, I can go and count how many mailboxes archive database not equals null. Okay, so I have 15 on-premises, and I have 8 cloud-based archives. Okay. So that's the process of provisioning a cloud-based archive. Now, all the other things that you do to an on-premises mailbox, you should be able to do with the cloud-based mailboxes. We can go and take a look at some of those. So, create a mailbox. You create an archive, create a cloud-based archive. Enable an archive for an existing mailbox. You can enable an archive for the cloud. Move an on-premises mailbox, or archive rather, to the cloud. Now, this is where all the glue that goes between your on-premises and the cloud really comes into play, and I think is really cool, too. To have a mailbox, or an archive rather, from your on-premises and to be able to move it to the cloud is pretty cool. And you can also do the same thing in reverse. You have an archive in the cloud and you can pull it back to your on-premises Exchange 2010 server. So there is a lot of portability of the data. And it's the same move mailbox requests that you use to move mailboxes on-premises. We use the same thing to move those mailboxes or archives to the cloud and move them back. Disable the archive, just like disabling a mailbox. There is one difference, though, when you go to the cloud. In on-premises, you can have a disabled archive and just keep it there. Okay? After a while, the mailbox database cleanup will run, depending on your settings, and it will clean up the disabled mailboxes if you want it to. In the cloud, we only store disabled archives for about 30 days. After that, they're permanently gone. There is no way to retrieve that data. So that's something you need to be careful of when you disable an archive in the cloud. Reconnect a disabled archive, again, like reconnecting a disabled mailbox. The caveat here is you cannot reconnect an archive, a cloud-based archive, to another user. It has to be the same user that you disconnected it from. That's a good question. And I was waiting for somebody to ask it, actually. So not too long ago, we introduced a tool called PST Capture. It's a free tool. Just go to aka.ms/PST Capture, and you should be able to get that tool and read more about it and download it. And what PST Capture does is it lets you mine PST files if you want to from users' workstations. And you suck those PSTs and bring them to a file server. And from there, you can now pull that data into the user's mailbox. Now, you can pull that PST into the user's primary mailbox. You can put that PST into user's on-premises archive. You can pull that PST and put it into a user's cloud-based archive, but only for the full Office 365 deployment, which means the primary mailbox also needs to be in the cloud. So for right now, that PST cannot be pushed to the cloud-based archive in the EOA. Okay, so if your user has primary on-premises and cloud-based archive, you can't directly push it to the cloud-based archive. So what do? You push it. There's two ways to go about it. You put that PST, you create an on-premises mailbox archive first and push that PST in there. Or what you can do is import all that PST data into the user's primary mailbox. And then let the archive policy move all that data to the cloud based on your move policies. We'll take a look at that. Yes. Yes. It can definitely take quite a lot of time, certainly. And you know, but at the same time, you know, when you first hear about it, it sounds like, oh, wow, how can this even be done? When you actually see this, you know, it somehow makes sense. You know, you move a mailbox from one Exchange server to another. Everybody's done that, right? Move requests. It's easy. But when you're on-premises, what it uses is Exchange system objects to move between XSO, to move between one mailbox database to another mailbox database, either on the same server or another mailbox server in your Exchange organization. Now, when you get to the cloud, how do you move it? Well, it's the same XSO, but we do not have the luxury of using RPCs to the cloud and using all kinds of ports to go to the cloud, right? Because we all want it to be secure or more secure than what's running in our trusted internal networks. So it still uses XSO, but it puts it in a HTTPS packet. And it moves all that to the cloud, and things can be moved back similarly. Sort of similar to Outlook Anywhere, right? You use HTTPS to connect to a mailbox. You're not using MAPI, and you're exchanging data. This is somewhat similar, but not. I don't want to go into all the details of how, you know. But suffice it to say, it's HTTPS. And yes, more data will take more time. I mean, there's no button here I can click and say, oh, upload my 25 gig PST into cloud in 5 minutes. No, we do not have that facility available right now. It's all self-service, okay? So to import data, to export data, you do not have to call support. You do not have to call Microsoft. You can do it all by yourself. And that's the beauty of this. That's the way this has been implemented. Okay, so let's go take a look at quickly creating a cloud-based archive. So I am here in my EMC, the same familiar tool that I use to manage on-premises, right? And I'm going to go ahead and do it for a new mailbox first. So I'm going to say new mailbox. Now let's quickly run to the wizard. You've done this procedure a number of times, I trust. So I'm not going to explain everything here. We're going to create a new user. Okay. Let's call the new user. I don't know if Scott Schnoll is in there, but let's do a Scott Schnoll. Let's change the UPN suffix. So this is very familiar. We've all done it. Move on. Okay, where do I want to place this user? I'm just going to skip and accept all the defaults, not assigning any policies here, and come to the important part, which is the archive settings. So here you have the option of either not creating an archive for this new mailbox. You can create a local or on-premises archive that resides on your Exchange 2010 servers, and you can select a mailbox database for that archive, but we want to go ahead and create a cloud-based archive. So let's select create a remote hosted archive and select the Exchange Online organization that will get created once you're done running EOA setup, and we'll go through some of the steps. So there'll be only one of these to select, so there's really no point in having the selection at all. But since it's there in the UI, we'll just go do it. And click Next. And there we go. And it's possible it'll say this user already exists. But let's go take a look. There we go. So it went ahead and created the mailbox. It went ahead and created the cloud-based archive. And you can see the attributes or the parameters that it used to create the cloud-based archive here. It's remote archive switch. So instead of dash archive, which you do for on-premises, you say dash remote archive. That creates the cloud-based archive. In addition to remote archive, you also need to specify your Exchange Online domain. So, dash archive domain. And in this case, it is e15rocks.mail.onmicrosoft.com. Now, the process that we talked about a few slides ago is going to kick in when it sees a cloud-based archive being created. DirSync is going to pick it up from there. It's going to replicate it to Exchange Online. And once it gets replicated to our data center, the cloud-based archive will get provisioned. Okay, so far so good. The beauty of this is I can, now it says the status here, cloud-based archive pending. Okay, so that process has been kicked in. Let's quickly go to the shell and do test MAPI connectivity. Okay, now let's do a get mailbox, schnull, and let's do a store archive star. Oops, it should be select archive. Okay, so here we will see archive status. So the write back has not occurred from the cloud back to on-premises. So our on-premises Exchange does not know that the cloud-based archive has been created. If I wanted to accelerate this process of DirSync and then write, I could run a command, and let's take a look at what that command is. It's start-online coexistence sync will allow you to kick that process in sooner on your DirSync server. Let's see if we can go ahead and run that on my DirSync box here. Okay, so that's all it took to kick in that DirSync manually to the cloud. Now, does that mean the write back from the cloud to on-prem is going to occur quickly? No. That could still take hours, okay? But I want to be able to go to my cloud organization, and I want to be able to find out if the mailbox is actually provisioned or not. I'm just trying to show you here. You don't need to do this. It'll all happen automatically. But let's try and go to. So I have this function to connect to my cloud-based archive in PowerShell, which is in my PowerShell profile. So I'm just able to say EXO and run that script, basically. Prompts me for my credentials for the cloud organization. I can say absunasia@e15rocks.com and use my password. So I'm connecting using PowerShell to Exchange Online in the cloud. And it's just like connecting to another Exchange server, but I'm using credentials. Now, I just created the mailbox, the cloud-based archive for Schnull. What happened is it created the mailbox account in my on-premises AD, and then DirSync probably has already finished replicating, and it created a mail user. Okay, in the cloud, just like your cross-forest topologies if you use multiple forests. So I can say get mail user. Let's see if Schnull is here. Oh, there we go. Scott Schnull is there. So let's see if the archive creation all has already occurred. Okay. Okay. So, but this gives you an indication of the fact that everything is in order here. The account has been replicated, and I can go and access it on premises. So, coming back to on premises, the write back has probably still not occurred here. So I'm still getting a status of none on that archive. Okay. How do I go and flip it? I know that it has already been created in the cloud. So I'm going to go and fire up, let's say, users. Properties, let's go to the attribute editor, which is not viewable in a normal mode. So I'm going to say view advanced features. Okay, now let's go back to users. There we go. And go back to Schnull. There we go. And properties. Okay, so here's the attribute editor. So previously you had to use etc/edit to edit attributes. Now you can do it within Active Directory users and computers. And let's go to, I think the attribute is called MS Exchange Archive. Okay, so here are the attributes. And archive status is right now not set. I'm going to click it, and I'm going to change it to 1. It's a binary field. It's either 0 or 1. Okay. Now let's go back to our PowerShell and see what this thing has to say. There we go. It now says active. So the write-back process can wait. It can take hours from the cloud to write back to your Active Directory. But we checked that the archive was, in fact, created in the cloud, and we manually came to on-premises and manually flipped that bit to show it as active. If I go back into my EMC, and if I hit refresh, instead of saying cloud-based archive pending, it's now going to say cloud-based archive has been created. Okay? Any questions so far on the provisioning process? Now I can go ahead and do the same things that I do with my on-premises mailboxes. I can go ahead and disable the archive if I wanted. I can remove the archive if I wanted. I can create a move request. Now there's some caveat with move requests with cloud-based archive. You can't use EMC. The interface will actually show you that you can do it, but you can't, okay, because it uses a wrong command, so that needs to get fixed before you can actually do it from EMC. So you can use PowerShell commands, and I'll show you how to do this. But let's go ahead first and start trying to access. Let me log out as Bharat. Okay, and I'm going to log back in as Schnall. Okay, so first time log on, it's going to ask me the time zone and language and so on. And so I have my primary mailbox here, and I have the cloud-based mailbox here. And at times, it just takes a little bit more time for this to kick in. But just like you saw it in my account, you can actually access it using OYN Outlook. Okay, so with that part done, let's move on to move an on-premises archive to the cloud and move a cloud-based archive to on-premises. Both these procedures are shell only. Okay, let's go ahead and find my shell command here. And I need to go ahead and move my on-prem mailbox to the cloud. Now, this procedure needs to be performed using shell connected to your Exchange Online organization. So let's do this first. Let's go ahead and Okay, let's go ahead and take a look at the user account, Mossad. Okay, so this is in the cloud right now. Let's try an on-premises archive instead. So let's go ahead and do a get mailbox with filter. Archive database not equals null, and select first one. Okay, so this is the alias, and we can try moving this account to the cloud. And I'm just going to replace okay, so new move request, identity of the user, move archive only, and you're specifying archive domain, which is your cloud-based domain or cloud-based organization, and you're saying it's a remote move, and then the remote host name. Already has an archive mailbox. Okay, let's try doing the reverse. Let's try moving from cloud to back to on-premises, and then we can move the same mailbox back. So it's the user here is Mossad. We already saw his properties. Now this moves from the cloud back to your on-premises organization. So here I'm saying move user Mossad at e15rocks.com, archive only, and it's an outbound request from the cloud to on-premises, and the most host name is my hybrid server on-premises. And in this case, since I'm moving it from the cloud to an on-premises server, I have to specify a mailbox database where I want it to be moved, and then I have to specify credentials for my cloud-based organization. So okay. Seems like we're having an issue here. source user MOSAT doesn't have an archive mailbox. Let's go get mailbox MOSAT. Okay, it does show it has a cloud-based archive. Doesn't want to move it right now. Rather than troubleshoot it, you get the gist of what is possible here. And unfortunately, I can't show it to you right now. So we'll just move on. So all the normal mailbox management tasks, including move mailboxes. Now the client access, how does the client access work? It's accessible using Outlook, it's accessible using OWA, but you're pointing your clients to your on-premises servers. So Outlook starts up, connects using AutoDiscover. AutoDiscover sends it a response back, says where is your primary mailbox and where your cloud mailbox, whether it's on-premises or in the cloud. Once it says that, it can connect to the CAS server in the cloud in Exchange Online and retrieve the archive in the cloud. How does OWA work? It's even simpler. OWA simply connects to your on-premises CAS, and your on-premises CAS proxies the request to the cloud and fetches the data for the user. So it's an OWA proxy. Now, if you have issues with connecting to your archive, just take a look at the users, AutoDiscover. So right-click on the icon, the Outlook icon in the tray, and select Test Email Auto Configuration. And when you do that, this window pops up, and you have the Use AutoDiscover checked, and click on the Test button, and it will return the XML, the actual XML that the AutoDiscover provides. And in there, you can see alternate mailbox is your cloud-based archive or on-premises archive. In this case, it says alternate mailbox. Mailbox is type archive, display name, and the legacy DN is, you can see it's in the cloud, and how to connect to it. Oh, before I go further, there's also a command in SP2, test-archive connectivity. That will also help you. And it'll go through actually some of the same steps, but does a end-to-end archive test. So let's take a look at what the setup looks for EOA. So there is your Exchange mailbox servers at the bottom. There is your client access servers. Now they provide the on-premises mailbox and all the glue that goes with it. Remote archive access using the CAS on-premises. Then you have the DirSync server, which is on top, which does your archive provisioning. And then there is Active Directory Federation Services, or ADFS, which does single sign-on. Okay? Now, switching back to our how Outlook connects, if you look at it, Outlook connects to on-premises first, then connects to the cloud. Okay? So there's two user accounts, and when it connects, makes a separate connection to the cloud, it may be prompted for a different password, right? So this is where ADFS comes in, and it synchronizes your on-premises. It basically trusts your on-premises Active Directory to issue tokens, and then the cloud will respect the same token, which means the user will not see additional password prompts. It's totally optional, but we highly recommend it to have the best user experience that you deploy ADFS. So these are the components that go into it. DirSync, again, operating on HTTPS. ADFS to trust for single sign-on, so no additional passwords. And your normal mailbox and CAS servers. Now, there was a session earlier, Configuring Hybrid Exchange the Easy Way, and Ben covered a lot of these in great detail. So I'm going to take a quick look at what the steps were. So you sign up for Office 365 or for Exchange Online Archiving, EOA, and you perform the same steps that you do for hybrid, except setting up the transport connectors. So let's take a look at the steps involved. You add your registered domains to Office 365 account. You have to give a proof of that you own those domains, which is done by creating a text record in your external DNS. So we can go and check that text record that you created, and we know that you actually own that domain. Once that is done, you can optionally add ADFS for single sign-on. Configure DirSync. Again, DirSync does not go on a domain controller. You can install it on an existing Exchange server, or if you have a larger deployment, you probably need a separate box running DirSync. Then enable DirSync write-back, which is required for archive provisioning to complete so that we can perform the write-back. And then there's a WCF download that you have to install, and there's a link on the screen here. Next, you probably already have on-premises Exchange servers, so 5 is just there. 6, configure Cloud Autodiscover DNS record. Okay, that allows your on-premises users to figure out where to connect to in the cloud. Publish MRS proxy, which allows you to move mailboxes to the cloud and back. And then configure the Federation Trust and org relationship, which allows you to do all kinds of stuff, including remote archive access, cross-premises e-discovery, MRM move to archive, and so on. And then very, very important is the last step, synchronize retention policies. So you have on-premises retention tags and retention policies. You need to export it to the cloud. We'll take a look at that. Now, if you're on Exchange 2010 SP2, steps 6, 7, and 8 are all automated using the hybrid configuration wizard that we shipped in SP2. There's an additional tool available online, XDeploy or Exchange Deployment Assistant. You can go there. You can choose the green option, which is hybrid. You can answer some of these questions the way I've shown here, and it will give you a PDF file with step-by-step instructions on exactly how to do this. So a lot of detail involved, and you get all the checklists to run through. Now, how do we move data to the cloud? So one of the things you talked about was PSTs. How do I move 25 gigs? So we talked about the PST capture tool. In addition, you have these retention policies. Now, when you have, well, what are retention policies? They're retention tags that basically say what to do with the message after X amount of time. Now, there are two parts to this. One is a move policy, and one is a delete policy. The move policy you apply to entire mailbox, and you can say automatically move mail to the archive and specify a time period, let's say 2 years or 700, whatever number of days it comes down to. Okay? And it moves all that data automatically. If the archive is on-premises, it'll move there. If the archive is in the cloud, it will move the data to the cloud. The delete policy deletes messages. So you say, I want these messages to be in mailboxes for 7 years, okay? You set a delete policy for your entire mailbox. You can set delete policies or retention policy tags for your default folders, inbox, deleted items, let's say 30 days, my junk mail folder, let's say 14 days. So once these items move to the cloud after 2 years, they will still follow that delete policy that you set and delete it from the cloud or from your on-premises archive in 7 years. So how do we implement these? We create retention tags. And all we need to specify in the retention tag is whether it's a move tag or a delete tag. Okay? We need to specify whether it's for a default folder, like the inbox, or deleted items, sent items, and so on, or it is for the entire mailbox, which is known as a default policy tag. That applies to all items that do not have a tag. Okay? Now, examples, move item to the archive in 2 years, delete junk mail or delete all items in 7 years, delete junk mail in 14 days, and so on. In addition to that, you can give users personal tags. Personal tags show up, I'll show you on the next screen, allow the user to bypass these policies and say, messages in this folder, never move them or never delete them, okay? Messages in another folder, move them at a certain time. But you, as the administrator, get the power to create those personal tags if you want to and allow your users to use those personal tags, okay? So that's the difference between a policy-based stuff that the admin does and then a user's tag or personal tag that the user now shows up in Outlook and OWA, and they can apply it to a folder. They can also apply it to an individual item. So your folder says, delete this item in, 7 years, but they can change it for one particular item in that folder and say, never delete this item. It's up to you whether you want to allow that or not by creating personal tags. Retention policies group all these tags and basically allow you to apply a bunch of tags to a user. More details on aka.ms/retention tags, or just retention. So in the EMC, you basically go to organization configuration, mailbox, and retention policy tags, and retention policies. These are the two tabs. You create tags, like the one you see on screen. You say the tag type. In here, I've created a default policy tag for the entire mailbox. You specify number of days, and then you say what to do at the end of that period, which is move to the archive, or the other options are either delete or delete permanently. The delete allows you to still recover the item after deletion. Permanently delete means there is no recovery. This is what it's going to look like for the user in Outlook, and some elements also visible in OWA. They can apply a different tag to a folder and a different move tag to that folder, or they can apply, on the right side you see, a different tag to the item itself and change what the policy says. Again, only if you, the IT administrator, allows them to do this. And they can see the expiration date, when the item will be deleted, stamped in the item itself. So that is displayed by Outlook and Outlook Web App. Then you can create some additional retention tags which are not part of the user's policy. But if you want, you can allow users to go to their ECP page in OWA and basically pick additional retention tags and add them to their mailbox. So now they just have a larger number of personal tags to choose from if you want them to. Now, what applies the retention policy? One of the more important things to remember here is retention policy applies to mailbox users. That means the same policy applies to the primary mailbox as well as the archive. So when I say delete all mail in 7 years, it's deleted from your primary mailbox as well as the archive. The other thing is, a lot of people ask the question, what if they have the same time period? I'm deleting an item in 2 years. I'm moving it to archive in 2 years. What happens first? Does the move happen or the delete happens first? Does it really matter? Eventually, it's going to get deleted. But if you really want to know, yes, the delete will occur first. So an item, two tags, move and delete at the same time, the delete will occur first. The item will never get moved. Typically, you want the move tag to be of a lesser time and the delete tag, move first and then delete. Also, what happens when an item has multiple tags? There is a tag on the entire mailbox, there is a tag on the folder, and there is a tag on the item itself. Anything that is directly applied to the item gets precedence, which makes sense, just like your NTFS permissions and so on. Now, there's a process called the mailbox, MRM mailbox assistant. You also know it as the managed folder assistant, which processes mailboxes, applies these retention policies, and makes sure items get moved or deleted. Now, earlier, this was a schedule-based assistant. That means you specified a time when this assistant ran, processed the mailboxes. Let's say you ran it for 6 hours early in the morning. There were chances that it would never finish processing all mailboxes. Some mailboxes will remain unprocessed. So in SP1, we made this assistant a throttle-based assistant. And what that means is it's always on. There is no more scheduling, okay? But we make sure that it doesn't consume a lot of resources, but at the same time, all your mailboxes get processed. And the only thing that you can configure now, there is no schedule anymore, no when to start, when to stop. What you can control is what is known as a work cycle. The work cycle basically says, process all mailboxes in this amount of time. Typically, it is 1 day, which is also the default. It makes sense to just leave it like that in most deployments. There is also an additional item called, parameter called the work cycle checkpoint. So if my work cycle is 1 day, so I need to process all mailboxes in a day, the checkpoint basically is 6 hours or 12 hours. When I interrupt that process, go back and see which mailboxes have not been processed for a long time, move them up higher in the priority queue, see if there are any new mailboxes created, and move them into the queue a little bit higher so they have an opportunity to get processed first. So work cycle and work cycle checkpoint are the two things you can configure. Now the concept of retention hold is basically user is leaving for an extended vacation. Retention hold allows you to say, hey, put all retention policies on hold. Don't delete, don't move this user's items. So the user has an opportunity to come back and look at their mail before it gets deleted. Here's the commandlet for that. I'm going to skip all of that and go to the important part in deploying EOA, is you want to take all these retention policies and tags that you've defined on premises, and you want to export them to the cloud before you create your first EOA or cloud-based mailbox, or cloud-based archive, rather. So we ship a script here called exportretentiontags.ps1 that is in your scripts folder on Exchange. It creates a nice little XML with the definition of all the retention tags and retention policies. And then you can go into your PowerShell session with the cloud and run importretentiontags.ps1, give it path to that XML file. It will do the synchronization for you. What is important to know that this is a manual process, that this replaces everything that is in the cloud. So every time you create a new retention tag or a policy, you need to do this export and make sure the cloud has it as well. Very, very critical. Okay? Because if the cloud doesn't have this policy, it's never going to delete messages in the cloud. The other thing, and we are running, unfortunately, running out of time a little bit, so hold policy. So this is different than retention hold. This says, okay, if I am going to have an e-discovery request for this user here, I'm going to put his email on hold, on legal or litigation hold, and the user can do whatever they want, but we will never delete their email. So a copy of that email will always be available in what is known as the recoverable items store, or previously known as dumpster in previous versions. We don't call that anymore. It also captures any changes that are made to an item, which is still in the mailbox, okay? User goes, clicks on it, changes the item, changes recipients, changes whatever. We will make a copy of that before that item is written back to the store. And if user makes 10 changes, we will have 10 copies of that item, including the original and every single change after it. So when you perform an e-discovery, all these versions will show up, and you will know what exactly happened to the item. Now, messages will not be deleted until you remove the user from hold. So let's say your case goes on for 2 years. For 2 years, all these items are going to keep collecting in the recoverable items store. And they will be indexed and they will be available for discovery. You can do it in ECP on the left. You can do it in EMC, the screen on the right. Enable litigation hold. You can provide a URL to a web page on your intranet that says why they are on hold or what hold means and so on. You don't have to, but there's an option to do that. The comments that you enter here for litigation hold are shown in Outlook 2010 if you wanted to inform users that they are on hold. Let's take a look at what that's going to look like. But before we do, this is what e-discovery looks like. So down there on the recoverable items, we've searched all the messages that the user deleted. So e-discovery allows you to look for all these messages. This is what it's going to look like in Outlook in the backstage area. The comment that you specify will show up here after you put the user on legal hold. The other concept is rolling hold. And rolling hold basically allows you to say, oh, I want to hold all email for 7 years at least. Okay? You do this using single item recovery, and you set it that period to 7 years. And after the user deletes the message, that item will be retained for at least 7 years. The downside is, if the user does not delete it till 6 years and 10 months, now it goes to the deleted items, to the recoverable item store, it's going to be retained for another 7 years. So remember that part when you're setting this. And I think we're almost out of time, but let me swip through. Auditing and discovery, and how discovery works. So basically, discovery is performed by users who have the discovery manager role. It's an RBAC role. You assign it to your HR folks or your lawyers, discovery managers. They can go ahead and search mailboxes on premises as well as in the cloud based on permissions assigned in that role. And then they can copy those messages to a discovery mailbox. And then you can either provide your, you know, whoever needs access to that discovery mailbox, you can provide access using mailbox permissions. You can also export that mailbox to a PST file using mailbox export request. So if you have any questions, we're out of time, but I'm outside and I'll be at the booth for the rest of the day. If you have any questions, please feel free to swing by and ask the questions. There's some related content here. Additional track resources. Again, all the aka.ms URLs. And the PowerPoint is downloadable, so you will have these. More TechNet resources, evaluations. Please remember to submit one. And finally, if you're going to join us for the Microsoft Exchange Conference in September in Orlando, the URL is mechisback.com. This is the conference that we earlier used to have for Exchange only. Great. Thank you for attending. We're running a little bit over. So questions I can take on the side.